ahead, I'm starting.
Hi, welcome everyone. You are on the Parenting 101 teleclass, what every expectant and new parent should know. For those of you new to our teleclass series, my name is Heather Alita. I'm a co-founder of Mommy Bites. We do free online classes regularly. And if you're kind of new to our format, you are all muted right now, so you don't need to worry about background noise. To ask a question, you can either chime in by pressing *7 on your phone, or you can type a question, which many, many people have started doing. We have this great new platform, so it's super easy to type in a question. You'll see by the Weill Cornell logo on your landing page, you'll see a little box that says ask a question. You can ask as many as you want. You can fill in your name or not fill in your name if you want it to be anonymous. So I'll be taking real questions sort of throughout the next hour or so. And we will also be taping this. So I'll send you all a link to this taped call. I know a lot of people like to kind of listen and don't feel like they need or want to take notes. So I'll send you guys all a link to this taped call. Also, a huge, huge shout out and thank you to our sponsor of today's teleclass, Weill Cornell Medical Associates. Weill Cornell Medical Associates is proud to offer academic medical care in a private practice setting for everyone in your family from newborns through adults. They are the primary care practices of the Weill Cornell Physician Organization, the full-time faculty practice of the world-renowned Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital. They provide comprehensive primary care at their 6 offices. We were just talking about they have a lot of brand spanking new offices located on the Upper East Side, Upper West Side, Tribeca, and should you need it across the finest array of specialty care in New York. And I don't know if any of you heard me chatting to our awesome expert, Dr. Sandover, before, but I actually use Weill Cornell for both my OB and my pediatrician, and they are phenomenal. So I really can't say enough good things about them. So without further ado, let me introduce you to our awesome, awesome expert, Dr. Sandover. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the introduction.
You are so welcome. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of all this, can you just talk a little bit about your background, and then we'll start with some of these common questions.
Sure. So I went to medical school at the University of Buffalo, so upstate New York. I did my training with Cornell, actually, at New York Presbyterian in New York City, Cornell Hospital. And I spent a year after doing residency in a private practice in Brooklyn Heights. And then I started here just a few months ago. So, you know, I'm back with Cornell. It feels like I'm back home, and it's been great so far.
Awesome. Well, I'm happy to have you. I'm part of your parent body, so I'm happy to officially meet you.
Thank you.
All right, so let's get started, everyone. Also, I just want to touch on some general themes that we are hoping to cover, so you know you can kind of tuck this away as you're listening. We're going to cover some things to think about really while you're at the hospital. We're going to talk about some things to think about at your first visit to the pediatrician, maybe some red flags to think about, some routine handling of newborns. We also want to – hold on, let me just see. We're getting some background noise here. Let me see if I can – yeah. We also are going to take questions real time, and one of the questions that came in, which is an excellent question, is on adoption and the unique things to think about if you've adopted a newborn. So I want to just tell that caller, we actually did a whole class just on adoption, which I will send to you just for the sake of time. I don't know how in-depth we'll be able to get into specific adoption concerns, but I will send everyone a link if you have adopted. Also, the other thing that we're not going to spend a lot of time on, and I will send you a link to, we did a whole class on it, is nursing. So we dedicated an hour to how to start the process, concerns, engorgement, milk supply, storage of milk. So I will send all of that to you as well. Okay, so let's get right into it. So Dr. Sandover, can you talk a little bit about what parents can expect when they go to the hospital and in sort of the early birth stages and what they can expect right after the birth?
Sure. So, you know, it's speaking pretty generally because every experience is different, whether you're in the hospital or in a birthing center, whether your baby is born vaginally or via C-section. But generally, you could expect a few kind of standard things. So once your baby is born, as long as they're crying and they're healthy and they look okay, you'll be able to most likely meet your baby just for a few moments. And then the nurse or doctor is going to want to take them and examine them. And they assign a thing called Apgar scores, which really are just some scores that measure your baby's like overall responsiveness right after birth. So it's, if you've heard of these things before, it's nothing to be like nervous over. It doesn't predict how healthy your baby's going to be as he or she grows up, but it's a score just to let kind of the healthcare professionals know like how well your baby is transitioning like right after delivery to being in the outside environment. After that happens, after your baby, the nurse or the doctor examines your baby, they're going to get a vitamin K injection. So this is an intramuscular injection in their thigh. And the vitamin K is necessary for normal blood clotting for an infant. So it just promotes the infant's blood clotting factors kind of right from the beginning. So not just, you know, not the most pleasurable experience in the beginning, but it is necessary for a baby. So if you do see the injection, a lot of the times the dad will ask, you know, or say, you know, our baby got an immunization right from the beginning, but it's not actually an immunization, it's the vitamin K. And if you do have any questions during the delivery and this process, you should always ask the staff. You shouldn't be scared to ask anybody questions. Another thing that typically happens is your baby will get an antibiotic ointment cream, or an ointment rather, so it's like kind of goopy, clearish and goopy ointment in their eyes, and this is to prevent infection from like any sort of bacteria that they may have encountered during the birthing process. So when your baby gets handed back to you, don't be alarmed if they have a little clear ointment goop in their eyes. After all this has happened and your baby is okay, then your baby will be given back to you, and this is like the first time that you're able to bond with your baby, and you might even have the opportunity to have your baby latch. So it's a great, great first time experience to bond and to breastfeed your baby at that point. So now after delivery, I can talk about some things that you can expect in the nursery. Is that okay?
That would be great. Yeah, that would be
okay.
Great.
So after delivery happens and you've bonded with your baby, there's a few standard things that will happen in the short nursery stay. So one important thing is that your baby will have a hearing screen at some point, usually, you know, a day prior to discharge, and it's going to test the hearing in both of your baby's ears. So now it is just a screen, so sometimes the baby doesn't pass the first time, which can happen for various reasons. Sometimes there's just like some fluid and debris in the ear canal, so they just will have to repeat the test and they may pass the second time. If they don't pass the second time, then they may need to see a specialist, and this is something that you would talk to about your pediatrician. So definitely remember to bring the results of your hearing test with your first pediatric appointment. Another thing that occurs is that babies will be offered his or her first immunization, which is the hepatitis B vaccine. So this is the only vaccine that's safe to give in the first, 0 to 6 weeks of life, and it is offered routinely in the nursery. So it's something to think about. You know, if it is recommended by the AAP and the CDC to give in the nursery, but it's something that you want to talk about with your pediatrician, you can certainly wait till your pediatric visit, or you can discuss it with them kind of beforehand. Another important thing that happens is that your baby will get a newborn screen. And, you know, every state is different, but generally all states are going to have some sort of screen with chest for congenital conditions, like some metabolic disorders and inherited conditions that can present in the first month of life that we would want to know right away. So it's generally a heel stick, and it's like a small amount of blood on a sheet of paper, actually, and it gets sent out to your state processing center, and the results come back within the first month of life to your pediatrician. So usually we say no news is good news, but if it does come back positive, most likely will need to be repeated, and that's just something that you'd have to talk about with your pediatrician. So just remember to, in New York State we have a thing, it's a pink slip. It might be different in each state, but we like the moms to bring in their pink slip so we can keep track of that newborn screen ID number. Another thing that occurs in the nursery is that your baby is going to be checked for jaundice. Now, this being said, every baby is going to have some sort of jaundice, which is yellowing of the skin, And it's just a result of having bilirubin, which is something made in, and processed by the liver, in the bloodstream. So all infants are born with a somewhat immature liver, and the liver gets mature very quickly in the first few days of life. So all babies are going to have some sort of high bilirubin level, which results in jaundice in the first few days of life. And this will be checked, and you know, we're checking really the baby's risk level for developing like significant jaundice that may need to be treated with light therapy. So the day before or the day of the discharge, a nurse will check your baby's bilirubin level, which is either done through the skin, like on a kind of like a scan, like a transcutaneous scan, or it's done through blood, which would be like a heel stick, or sometimes it's done both in both ways. The nurse or doctor will assign a risk category to the jaundice level, whether it's low or intermediate or a high risk, and this will determine how quickly your baby needs to be seen by their pediatrician after discharge of the hospital. You know, that being said, most infants do need to be seen within 1 to 2 days of hospital discharge. So if you do, if your baby does have a high bilirubin check, you might level, you might need to be a little seen a little bit sooner, you know, the day after discharge rather than 2 days after discharge.
And how long, Dr. Sanderson, how long is the normal length of stay, you know, if everything is sort of on track?
Right, so that's a great question. Now, it's different for every baby depending on, you know, especially if it's like a vaginal delivery versus a C-section too, and that depends on the mommy as well. But most stays are, I would say, between like 2 and 4 days, usually 2 days if everything is going well for a vaginal delivery, and about 3 or 4 days for a C-section delivery.
Got it. Okay. Got it.
And that's another thing about discharge is that you want to make sure, I always tell parents to, you know, expecting parents to call their pediatrician's office, you know, who they know their doctor is going to be, like the day they know when they're going to get discharged. So say, you know, the first day is a little hectic, so you probably don't want to even be bothered with that. but sometimes, you know, if you remember, that's great. So you can say, you know, my baby was born today and I'm most likely going to be discharged tomorrow, so can I have an appointment within like 2 days? So this way you're kind of, you kind of check that box off and you have an appointment set up.
That's so smart, actually. That's great advice, because you do have a sort of window where they want you to have your first pediatrician visit, right? It's in the first
right.
3 or 4 days?
It's actually within 1 to 2 days of discharge, we normally say. So babies need to be seen on days 3, 4, or 5 of life, you know, definitely, unless, say, they were in the hospital for some other reason on day 4 of life and they've been checked by a pediatrician, and maybe then, you know, that's different. But say your baby was born and discharged, I'm sorry, was discharged on day 2 of life, they're going to be one to be seen by day 3 or 4 of life, most likely.
Got it. Okay, got it. All right, that's great advice. And Dr. Sandover, I know we said we were going to spend too much time on nursing, and for those of you that are just joining us, I will send you, we actually did a whole hour class on nursing and milk supply and engorgement, so I'll send that to you. But just briefly, can you talk a little bit about what parents should be aware of in those first few days with milk supply and what's considered, you know, how many wet diapers they should be looking for, if there's any red flags around sort of normal feeding in those first few days?
Sure. So the first thing to think about is if you do, you know, if your baby was crying at birth and is breathing normally and is healthy, you want to try to like bond with your baby and try to breastfeed right away, because that definitely has been shown to help with breastfeeding if your baby kind of like latches right away. Now that being said, if your baby needs a little bit of extra help afterwards and you don't have that opportunity, that's okay. As soon as they're okay to come and bond with you, then I would recommend just starting to put the baby to the breast right away. As far as like supply, so within the first couple days of life, moms will notice that they have colostrum, which is not the actual like full breast milk, but it's a substance that's typically like golden yellow in color. It's high in protein and also fat, and it contains some substances to protect your baby against infection. So it is a very important thing for your baby to get in the first couple of days of life. But moms will notice that there is, you know, there's very little amount of colostrum that's being produced. It's not full breast milk. And usually it can start to go away within the first couple of days of life. Usually about the third to fourth day, moms will notice that their breasts can start to become engorged and hard. And that's when their actual breast milk, their full breast milk is coming in, which is more white in color in appearance as opposed to like the yellow golden colostrum, and there's much more of the breast milk. That being said, you know, days three or four is when most moms have their breast milk come in, but in some cases it can happen a little bit earlier, like maybe on day two of life, and sometimes it can happen like later, like even day seven of life. So everyone's experience is a little bit different. One thing that moms should just be aware of is that they have to make sure to be hydrated themselves. So it's something that can, if a mom is not well hydrated, it can affect their milk coming in and it can affect their supply even from the beginning. So I always tell moms to remember to, you know, take care of themselves right from the beginning. And if dad or someone else is around, then they should always be giving mom a glass of water, especially when they're breastfeeding their baby to make sure that they're keeping themselves hydrated as well.
It's hard to do. I know. I used to have a little basket I used to carry from room to room just with water and snacks, and it's hard to remember. You're kind of full. You're full in it, and it's sometimes tricky to remember to take care of yourself. But it definitely affects
exactly.
milk supply.
Yeah, right. And you can be dehydrated too, so it's really important to up your fluids and to make sure you're staying healthy and. As well.
Exactly. Especially because you're probably not sleeping either. But that's a whole other teleclass.
Right.
So I had a question come in that I'd like to read to you. Oh, this is a good question. I'm sure you get this a lot. So this person wants to know. So she has friends and family that would like to come visit her baby right after delivery in the hospital. Is this safe? And is it okay for me to get them to wash their hands first, or is that unnecessary? I mean, it's hard. You don't want to be sort of the anal first time mom, but then there's also safety and hygiene involved. But
yeah, so it's difficult, and it's definitely a personal decision, because there's a lot of people who may want to see the baby, and everyone's really excited, especially if it's like a first like grandchild. And I say, you definitely want the people who are close to you to be able to see your baby, to enjoy this experience and share this experience in your life. But you have to make sure that everyone is washing their hands prior to touching the baby. And if someone has a runny nose, or even maybe feeling like a little bit tired, maybe they're catching something, then they should definitely not be in contact with the baby at all. So even if it's like the grandparent, I say, give them a few days and see if they're doing okay. And the safest thing is to keep anyone who's sick away from the baby. The reason is because newborn infants, they do get some of the immune cells, and immunoglobulins from mom, especially in the colostrum, but, not nearly enough to build an immune system. So even if a baby catches a cold, it can be something that's very serious within the first couple of months of life. So, and you can always, I always tell parents this, like, just blame me, blame the pediatrician, say the pediatrician didn't recommend, like, having too many visitors, or blame me that, you're being very crazy with hand washing, because it is really important. So everyone has their own rule, and I just tell, mom and dad to kind of, like, be on the same page about it, just so they can, and just try to, get on the same page right from the beginning, so they don't feel bad in every circumstance. Well, should we have this person over? They really want to come. But the most important thing is hand washing and keeping a safe environment around the baby, meaning having, healthy people who are not sick around the baby.
I used to always blame my pediatrician, so I think that's great advice. And I used to keep a thing of hand sanitizer just kind of right there.
Yeah,
near the crib or the bassinet, yes. And that way it's kind of a no-brainer. And I started to try to be more sensitive when I visit new babies, even in the first few months, even not new, and I'll walk in and I'll say to the new parent, I'm just going to run to the bathroom and wash my hands before I hold your baby. Like, I just try to take that on board, because it's hard, and you don't want to be the bossy new parent, but, it's your baby's health.
Right.
Important. Very, very. Along those same lines, this question just came in. Who should get the whooping cough vaccine? I'm sure you get this a lot with all vaccines, but let's pause and talk a little bit about vaccines and whooping cough vaccines in particular.
So the whooping cough vaccine is recommended for parents of the baby and close caretakers, and those people who are going to be around for more than just a few days. So usually, in most circumstances, it's like mom and dad, and if they have a nanny or like a baby nurse or someone helping out, the sibling should be up to date on their pertussis vaccine as well. And grandparents, because, you know, a lot of the times grandparents are going to be around for like a couple of weeks. So so I'll recommend any close caretaker who's going to be, you know, very involved with your baby in the first few weeks or first 2 months, really, of life, because your baby can't get their pertussis vaccine until 2 months. So they should have
Got
their
it.
Pertussis
okay.
vaccination.
Okay. That's,
and it is recommended with each pregnancy as well.
Oh, is it? Oh, with each pregnancy. So that's interesting. I don't think I realized
that. It is. Yeah, so the studies have shown that, you know, it's the Tdap, which contains the pertussis, that the pertussis vaccine actually, like, wanes every year. So if you've gotten it, you know, 3 years ago, there's been studies to show that even 3 years after, your pertussis immunity has gone down, like, significantly. So it's, even though it's, you know, you don't have to get it for every 10 years, is like the tetanus shot, cause it has, and it has the pertussis in it. The, like, for me, I'll get it, like, every three to 5 years because I'm a healthcare provider. But it actually isn't recommended unless you have a new infant until every 10 years or so.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. So let's switch gears a little bit, and again, I'll continue to feed questions in as they're typed to me. Can we talk a little bit about routine skincare? I remember I was terrified the first time I had to give my little guy a bath, and I wasn't quite sure about the whole umbilical cord, and do I leave it alone? Do I try to clean it? So if we could talk a little bit about routine skincare.
Sure. So this is, you know, definitely a lot of questions at the newborn exam and in the first 1 month of life, because a lot of skin ailments come up that usually are just benign. There's a lot of newborn skin rashes, which could be like a whole talk in itself because there's just so many things that can occur on your baby's skin, and usually everything is fine. So so one thing to keep in mind is that your baby's skin is transitioning from being in the womb, so like a warm bath, to being to an outside environment. So your baby's skin is going to change and is going to need to get used to being outside. So essentially your baby's skin will start to shed into like normal baby skin that's used to being in an outside environment. So you'll notice that your baby's skin is peeling in different areas, and that's okay. There's nothing to do with peeling skin. I don't recommend putting any lotions on the skin because it's not particularly dry. It's just kind of shedding off. And when you do put lotions on, it can sometimes make the peeling like more pronounced, so there's nothing really to do for it. In some circumstances, though, like by the hands, like the wrists and the ankles and some skin folds, the skin can get like very dry and it can start to get cracked. And in that case, you definitely do want to put some cream on. I recommend like, you know, petroleum jelly like Vaseline or Aquaphor to areas like that, and it usually heals up pretty well. And you want to remember that baby's skin is very sensitive. So once you do start to, you know, give your baby a bath or start using skin products, you want to use something that's very sensitive. So something that's non-scented and dye-free, and it's, you know, a gentle product is generally okay. Anything that has scents in it or a dye, that's not going to be too sensitive on your baby's skin. And to talk about bathing, so now, there's a couple of things you want to think about with bathing. So your baby's going to have an umbilical stump from the umbilical cord, and you can't submerge your baby into water until the umbilical stump falls off and has appropriately dried up. The reason is because if you submerge your baby into water and the umbilical stump gets very wet, then you could possibly introduce a little bit of infection, or if it gets wet, it might take a longer time to heal. So we just don't want to, you know, deal with that situation. So we say if you need to bathe your baby, then just do sponge baths. So just sponge bathe your baby kind of around the umbilical stump. And you don't have to bathe your baby frequently. I say, you know, if your baby's starting to get kind of dirty or smells, then you definitely want to do some sponge bathing. But once you get in like a typical routine, when the umbilical stump falls off and it is okay to submerge in water, I say like two, three times a week. You don't want to do it every day, especially when your baby's skin is just starting to transition and get used to being baby skin.
And how long after does the umbilical cord usually fall off?
It's really variable, but usually about like 1 to 2 weeks. It generally can fall off before then, especially if it kind of gets like caught on something, and that's okay as long as it dries up and heals well. And sometimes it can take longer than 2 weeks. So if it, you know, if it's taking longer than 2 weeks, you want to check in with your pediatrician and make sure it doesn't have any signs of infection, which would be like redness around the umbilical stump or any foul smell or any like pussy discharge or swelling. That would be signs to take your baby into the pediatrician right away.
Got it. Okay. And before we move on and talk about routine handling, and actually I'm going to give you another question that was just typed in, I just want to pause and again thank our awesome sponsor of today's telecraft, Weill Cornell Medical Associates. I will send you a link, but they're all over the city. They're phenomenal. They provide amazing care, and our expert on today's telecraft, Dr. Sandover, is actually from Weill Cornell Medical Associates. So huge thank you to them. So let's switch gears and talk a little bit about routine handling. And actually, this question that was just typed in is actually one of the things that we had on our list to talk about, which is smoking and being around smokers. So this caller asked, there are a set of grandparents that are heavy chain smokers, and they would like to be there when the baby is born. The nicotine aroma lasts on their clothes and skin for a long time. How do I handle that? Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah. So it's very difficult because, you know, secondhand smoke is not healthy for babies. It can irritate their respiratory system, and it can actually make them more prone to infections. Cigarette smoke exposure is actually one of the risk factors for sudden infant death syndrome as well. So it's something that we try to really keep away from babies. That being said, some people, you can help, you know, your family members or some parents are smokers and they do have it. You know, have some secondhand smoke, and secondhand smoke is not just like a cloud of smoke from smoke, but I think like the question was stating, it secondhand smoke, if you smell it on the clothes or the hands, that is actually secondhand smoke as well. So the first thing I recommend, especially when parents are smokers, is to quit smoking, and I offer help with quitting and, you know, talking to their doctor as well about quitting, so that's the best thing to do, but sometimes, you know, that's not possible. So the second best thing to do is that when there's a smoker who is going to be handling the baby, they want to make sure that they wash their hands really well, and they also like change their clothes. So I recommend having like smoking clothes that are kind of like out of the way and not exposed to the baby at all. And when they smoke, they can change into like their smoking jacket or their smoking clothes. But before they touch the baby, they should change their clothes into something that doesn't have any smoke on it, and they should make sure to wash their hands thoroughly.
That's really, really good advice because, you know, it's hard. You don't want to get into the battle of telling grandparents or friends and family that they can't smoke. Like, I'm not sure that they're going to be able to change that. But I really like that idea of having a different set of clothes. And also, maybe this is a time where they kind of blame the pediatrician and they say, you know, listen, our
exactly.
pediatrician, you know, told us that this is just as harmful as, you know, a cloud of secondhand smoke, which I think a lot
it
of
is.
Times people don't realize, well, because you know why? They can't smell it on themselves. Smokers often
right.
can't smell it on themselves. So, you know, maybe this is a time to kind of blame the pediatrician and say, well, they recommended having a you know, a set of clothes that you put on when you're handling the baby that hasn't been exposed to the smoke.
Definitely.
That's a really great question, caller. Thank you. I'm sure that actually comes up in a lot of families, so thank you. Thank you for that. And Dr. Sandover, what about sleeping on the back and bumpers and some of the routine handling in those first few days, safety-wise, that parents should keep in mind?
Sure. So, you know, the safest way to sleep and putting your baby down. So in the first, like, month of life, your baby is going to be sleeping a lot, sometimes up to 16 to 17 hours in the first couple weeks of life. And the safest way for them to be sleeping is going to be on their back. So not on their bellies, not on their sides, strictly on their back. And it's going to be on a firm mattress that's compatible with the up-to-date safety requirements. So you want to, before your baby is born, you want to make sure to set up like a very safe sleep environment because you're going to be putting your baby down, you know, as soon as you get home. Feeding and sleeping is the biggest thing in the first month of life. So making sure to have that firm mattress and to be always putting your babies to sleep on the back. The reason is because it decreases the risk of sudden infant death syndrome. So sometime in the 90s, the recommendation changed from, you know, sleeping on the belly or the sides to sleeping on the back. And after that time, we did see, like, a dramatic decrease in the rate of sudden infant death syndrome. So it is, you know, it's a proven a proven thing to be the safest way to sleep. A lot of parents do get nervous, you know, like what if the baby spits up? Are they going to choke on their spit up if they're not on their side? But we've seen that babies just, they know enough to like turn their head when they spit up and spit out. So it is still the safest way to sleep.
What's your take on bumpers? Yeah, because that
bumpers,
was, I'm telling
right.
you not to date myself, but they were still in vogue when my little guy was a baby. Everybody had bumpers, but that's changed, right?
Yeah, so that's changed. So we don't recommend any bumpers in the crib. So anything that can potentially harm your baby or suffocate your baby, we don't want in the crib. So no toys, no bumpers, no extra blankets. Just, you know, the clothes that you have on your baby and a swaddle blanket should be enough if the environment is room temperature. And that'll decrease the risk of SIDS as well, not having anything in the crib and no bumpers. And people, they worry, like, well, what if the baby, like, sticks their hand through the crib or can stick their head through the crib? But if you buy a crib that is compatible with, like, up-to-date safety requirements, then you should be fine. So just, you know, when you buy your crib, you can do, like, a Google search or just, like, look for seals of approval. Just make sure it's safe, and then you shouldn't have to worry about that. So, you know, like, antique cribs and, like, vintage cribs, they might be like really nice to look at, but they most likely aren't safe for your baby. So make sure you get like a new crib or one that's just up to date with the regulations.
Very, very important stuff. Very. And I know that Dr. Sandover touched on sleep. I'll also send people a link. We also did an online class on newborn sleep. So I'll send that to people as well.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about what happens at the baby's first visit to the pediatrician, which
sure.
you said is within 2 to 3 days, yeah.
Yeah, so it's usually within anywhere from like 1 to 3 days after discharge. So if your baby had a normal birth and is discharged like on day 2 of life, then your baby should be seen by days like 3, 4, or sometimes 5, if they're discharged on day 3 of life. So usually within the first 2 days. And you will get guidance from the pediatrician in the hospital on when your baby needs to be seen. It depends on how much weight they have lost or how high their jaundice risk level is. So say if it's like you're discharged on a Friday and you're nervous that you can't be seen until Monday. If your baby is doing okay and has a low risk jaundice and the pediatrician in the hospital okayed it, it can be okay to see your doctor on Monday. So this is something you definitely want to communicate with before your doctor in the hospital before you're discharged with your baby. So to talk about the first visit, so a lot of history is taken during the first visit, so that's usually the first thing that happens. We ask about how the pregnancy was there any complications, was there any blood work that was tested on mom that was positive and needed to be followed up in the baby, were there any abnormal ultrasounds, which can be something that you definitely want to keep track of, that, and most moms will know, but sometimes we don't have access to these records, so it's great to remember if there was something that needed to be followed up after birth. We also ask about the delivery history, how did everything go? We talk a lot about the things that happen in the nursery, like the hearing screen and whether they got hepatitis B or not, the jaundice level. And we even take like a comprehensive family history just to kind of, you know, get it from the beginning, things to possibly look out for in the future. After the history taken, we take the baby's weight, we do the length, the head circumference, we do all the baby's measurements and vitals. And we discuss a big, big topic of discussion during the first visit is the baby's weight. So a lot of parents don't realize that babies do lose weight after birth, and it's completely normal for a baby to lose weight. They have a ton of fluid on board in the beginning, so the first 2 days of life, they generally are still losing their weight from birth, and it takes them a few days to start gaining it. It's actually normal for babies to lose up to 10% of their birth weight in the first few days of life. So it just depends on how much your baby loses, where your pediatrician is able to kind of come up with a different feeding plan depending on how much weight your baby's lost. So this is one thing that we definitely talk about, and that comes into play with feeding. So we talk a lot about feeding. How is breastfeeding going? Do you need to supplement with formula if the baby's lost a lot of weight, or are you going to be formula feeding and not breastfeeding? And we discuss the different options. Some moms even have the babies latch onto the breast. I definitely have a lot of and encouraged a lot of my moms to have the baby. Just latch on the breast so I can see how everything's going. Can you work on the latch a little bit? Should we refer you to a lactation consultant? And we also talk a lot about stooling patterns and wet diapers. And the reason we talk about wet diapers and poops is because it gives us an idea of how hydrated the baby is and how well they are doing with feeding, really. We also examine the baby head to toe. So we repeat the newborn exam again. And some people are like, why do I need to come in like 2 days after a doctor just checked me out in the hospital? But things definitely do change on the baby's exam, especially like jaundice, and sometimes the heart exam changes, the weight changes. So it's very important, this exam that we do in the first few days of life. And speaking of jaundice, sometimes, if we do notice that the jaundice seems to have gotten worse, and a lot of the times it does get worse, honestly, because jaundice can peak days 3 to 6, and that's typically when you're in the doctor's office, and that's actually one of the reasons why we have babies be seen so early to check this. So if the jaundice seems to have gotten worse, then sometimes we'll have to do another skin test and follow it up with the parents. And a lot of questions happen during the first visit too. A ton of questions. And we actually go over, a lot of the things that we're talking about during this talk. We'll go over like visitors and hand washing and cribs and sleep. So it's a lot of an educational component as well during the first visit.
And then when is the follow-up visit after that?
So it really depends on every baby. So it depends on the weight, so how much weight the baby has lost. It depends on the jaundice. I would say those are the two things that really determine when the baby is going to be checked, and also how comfortable the parents are, too, with feeding. So say you think the baby's doing great and, they haven't lost that much weight, they're a low risk for jaundice, but the parents feel more comfortable coming in 2 days just to do a weight check. So it depends on those three things, the jaundice, the weight, and how comfortable the parents are. A lot of the time, too, women's breast milk is, the mom's breast milk is not in on the first day they're in, and they really, have strong wishes to breastfeed. So we do have to follow them a little closer to make sure that the breast milk comes in, that breastfeeding is going well. So I would say anywhere from 2 to 3 days to sometimes like a week later. But we do want to make sure that the baby regains the birth weight by 1 to 2 weeks of life. So you'll definitely need an appointment by then.
That's actually good to keep in mind, that pediatricians give that wiggle room of 1 to 2 weeks to regain the birth weight. Because as a new parent, you're kind of not prepared for that. You think, all right, so my baby should be gaining weight, and they've lost weight, and if they're going to gain it back, then it needs to happen in the first day or two. But that's nice and calming, I think, to know that it could take a week or two. So that's good to keep in mind.
And a lot of the time, it takes like 10 to 14 days, so it's completely normal. So it's right. So that's something that you're right. Parents do get very concerned about the first visit, but it's very unusual for a baby to have gained weight at discharge.
That's good to keep in mind.
Yeah,
I think it's really good and calming. Listeners, we have time for one or two more questions. So if you have any questions, please feel free to type them in. And the last thing I want to cover, Dr. Sandover, are red flags that new parents should think about and when you think they need to get in touch with their pediatrician sort of ASAP.
Definitely. So one big red flag that we like to talk about is fever. So fever in a baby up to 2 months of life is considered an emergency. The reason is because this can be a sign of a serious bacterial infection. It can also be the sign of a cold, but unfortunately, because babies have such an immature neurologic system that they can't show us the difference between having a cold or a serious infection, so a fever is very alarming to us. Now, you don't want to be checking your baby for a fever like every day. You don't have to. You don't have to do what they did in the nursery, because they will typically just do that routinely when you're in the hospital. But you don't want to do that when you're home. The reasons that you would take a temperature is if your baby is having some feeding difficulties, just not seeming as awake as they were before. If your baby is very irritable and doesn't want to be fed, is not calming easily, or if your baby feels warm and flushed looking, that's when you want to take a temperature. The only way to take a temperature that's going to be accurate in a newborn baby is rectally. So you can just get you don't have to get like a special rectal thermometer. You can just get a digital thermometer, and you insert the metal tip just into the rectum. You can put a little bit of Vaseline around it to make it a little more gentle. And then once the temperature registers, if it's 100.4, which is 38 degrees Celsius or 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit, that is a fever, and you want to call your pediatrician right away. Your baby will, if they do have a true fever, they will have to go to the hospital and get a workup for fever, which can include blood work, urine tests, and sometimes spinal fluid as well, depending how young the baby is. So this is definitely something to look out for and a big red flag. And this is just for the first 2 months of life. Once a baby gets vaccinated at 2 months, then we start to worry a little bit less about fever, but you still want to check in with your pediatrician when your baby gets a fever.
It's very good to know. And a sign of a good pediatrician, I know we've actually done classes on this too, what to look for. You want your pediatrician to take it seriously and get back to you, and you not feel like you're alone out there. So make sure you really feel connected. I mean, it's such an important relationship. And I think, again, we don't talk about that enough, but that's a very, very important relationship with your pediatrician.
It is. It's, a lot of parents are like, oh, I'm a crazy parent and you're going to be hearing from me so much and I have so many questions. But like, no, you're not. Everybody has questions. This is my job. Like, you weren't, your baby wasn't born with an instruction manual and this is what my training is. This is what I do every day. So please don't hesitate to, ask me questions.
Exactly.
And just to talk about a couple more red flags. So worsening jaundice. So we talked a little bit about that. So worsening yellowing of the skin, you want to touch base with your pediatrician right away. Any feeding difficulties, decreased urine or, decreased wet diapers. So we'll say this is a general rule of thumb within the first week of life, is that a baby should have one wet diaper, a newborn baby, with each day of life. And that goes till about like day 6 or 7. So on day 2 of life, babies should have 2 wet diapers in a 24-hour period. By day 6 of life, 6 wet diapers, and then after that, it's usually about anywhere from 7 to 12 a day if feeding is going well. So poor urine output can indicate either feeding difficulties or that your baby is getting sick. Other things you want to touch base with your pediatrician right away is any lethargy or limpness. If you're that concerned that your baby is limp, then you call 911. But if you're kind of like, oh, my baby just isn't as awake as they were, then you want to bring them in for a pediatric appointment. Another thing is uncontrollable crying and irritability. That's lasting for, your baby isn't hungry, you've changed their diaper, and they're crying for like over an hour, then you want to touch base with your pediatrician and have someone take a look at your baby. And anything that doesn't feel right, you want to touch base, because we know that everyone's new parents have questions and they're not doctors. We don't expect you to be. So if you're hesitating, then and you're not feeling right about something, call or come into the office.
Yeah, go with your gut, definitely. So I have one more question that has been typed in, so we have time for one more.
Sure.
And this caller asked, is there sleep scheduled to shoot for in those early days, weeks?
There's not really a sleep schedule because your baby in the first few weeks of life is going to be feeding and sleeping, and when they're going to sleep kind of when they want to in the beginning just to regain their energy for feeding. So the goal in the first couple of weeks of life and even the first month of life is to gain weight. So as much as you want to get them on a schedule, sometimes it's just not possible. I usually say after like 2 weeks of life when your baby has regained its birth weight, then you can try putting them on a schedule, especially during the day, like feeding anywhere from every 2 to 3 hours and trying to get the longer sleep stretches at nighttime. Now, that being said, it's something you want to talk about with your pediatrician depending on how your baby is doing, where they are in their growth curve. Is it okay to let them sleep for longer than 4 hours? So every case is different, but one thing you can start to do just early on is try to get away that night and day confusion. So that's something that's very common, and that can actually help like set up healthy sleep habits right from the beginning. So if your baby is sleeping all the time during the daytime and getting their like longer stretches during the day and up at night, you want to try to reverse that. So some things I suggest to parents are like taking walks with your baby like once a day or every other day, just to, like, so they sense sunlight during the day and they realize, like, this is the daytime. And then at night, try to the best you can to keep everything very dim and, you know, don't entertain or play with your baby too much at nighttime. Try to keep it, like, strictly about feeding. And that being said, it can be hard in the beginning because you want your baby might be super sleepy and they're falling asleep on the breast at night and you have to turn on the lights. But those are some things that you can do. Also, opening up the windows and letting sunlight in during the daytime is something that can help with them realizing that it's day.
It's a great question. Again, I'm sure you get that a lot with the sleep schedule, but it's good advice to day night. And then when can you start doing like a real proper sleep schedule? I think when my little guy was a baby, it was 3 months and 13 pounds or something.
Yeah. So I feel like right from 1 month is a good time that you kind of like you check in with your pediatrician. We do like a 1 month well checkup. And as long as babies are doing okay and they're gaining weight well, then I say like definitely try to get them on a schedule by 1 month and put them to bed at the same time every night. So you're establishing good, healthy like sleep habits and try to put them to sleep drowsy and don't get them used to rocking them to sleep the whole time. And then like let them sleep. If their weight is appropriate, you can let them sleep as long as they can. But usually by 4 weeks, the most they're going to sleep is about 5 or 6 hours. They're usually not going to sleep longer, especially if they're breastfed.
If you're lucky.
So, if you're lucky, exactly. Yeah.
Right,
so like
well,
establishing good habits, I say, and good
exactly.
routines right from the beginning is, and then you can kind of gradually build on that. So at 2 months, you might be able to eliminate one-time feeding. So keeping the same bedtime and trying to have that one stretch that gets longer and longer as the baby gets older to like 3 or 4 months. And 4 months, we say definitely the baby can sleep all throughout the night. But not that, you know, 6 hours might be by 1 to 2 months, you might have a 6 hour stretch, which can be pretty significant to the parent.
Oh, and so nice. So nice. Oh, this has been so great, Dr. Sandover. I really, really appreciate it. Again, big, big shout out and thank you to Weill Cornell Medical Associates. And
you're
thank
welcome.
You all our listeners. And thank you for all your great questions, everyone. And best of luck on your parenting.